Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What a computer is to me is it's the most remarkable tool that we've ever come up with. And it's the equivalent of a bicycle for our minds.
Steve Jobs, not surprisingly, in his own words, talking about computers, he was comparing them to something in the natural world. And we will, not just to bicycles, we will play a longer version of that clip later in the show as we talk about the legacy of Steve Jobs today, of course. Culturally, technologically, economically, Mayor Bloomberg likened him not just to Edison, which everybody seems to be doing, but to Einstein. So we'll come back to that later. If E equals MC squared, what is the value of I? Maybe we'd put it that way. But let's talk first about Occupy Wall Street. This is day 20 of the protest in Zuccotti Park that is supposed to last for 2 months. But rather than as time goes on and people have to get back to their daily lives, it dwindling, just look at the Occupy Wall Street headlines page on Google News this morning, and you will see how this political meme is spreading. Occupy Wall Street hits Connecticut today. That's one headline. Occupy Wall Street, Los Angeles branch. Occupy Wall Street gets hacker support. Occupy Wall Street comes to Southeast Idaho. I kid you not, from the website of Local News 8 in Pocatello, Idaho, Occupy Wall Street comes to Southeast Idaho. And it goes on. Yesterday, major unions joined in downtown. Two members of Congress have now signed a letter of support. We'll see if that spreads in the Democratic Party. And today's speakers at the main protest site in Zuccotti Park here in Lower Manhattan, among today's speakers will be best-selling author Naomi Klein, who wrote No Logo and The Shock Doctrine. The Shock Doctrine is her theory that when there's a crisis or a disaster, corporations exploit the moment to take more power away from governments and democracy in general. She definitely thinks the financial crisis of 2008 was used that way. Well, today, Naomi Klein will be speaking to the Occupy Wall Street protest and calls this the shock resistance. So let's find out more about what Naomi Klein thinks. Hi, Naomi. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back with you, Brian.
Remind us more of what's at the heart of the shock doctrine and why you call this the shock resistance.
Well, the thesis is that a lot of the policies that our elites favor because they're very profitable, privatization of essential services, cuts to regulation for them, are unpopular. I mean, everybody likes a tax break, but people tend to protect their public services. What I show in the shock doctrine is that the great leaps forward for this ideology, the times when it's been implemented very quickly and very radically, like Thatcher's Britain or Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, has been on the backs of major shocks, major crises. And what I show in the book is that there has long been an understanding among free market economists that in times of crisis, you're able to do things that you could not do during normal circumstances, particularly in democratic societies. And when there is a panic, when people are fearful, they will tend to trust the experts, and they will give up power, and they will say, okay, well, if it's really an emergency, we'll give up these things.
Perfect example. In 2008, in the fall, the crash was taking place. The whole country was like, oh my God, what do we do? So when Henry Paulson and Geithner and a few others came up with
the $700 billion stick up, as I called it.
right. The $700 billion TARP program, you know, stick up, people will decide in about six paragraphs of legislation,
yeah.
Tiny, tiny little, well, just give us the power to do whatever we think is necessary. And a lot of people at first said, yeah, okay, do whatever's necessary.
But actually, a lot of people at first said no. I mean, if you remember, there was the first stage was
the Republicans in Congress said no,
but also Democrats, and they were just flooded with calls, and they were in the middle of an election. They were in the middle of the 2008 election, and that is one of those moments when politicians tend to be a little bit more receptive to their voters,
right.
And so they had to go back twice to actually get TARP approved, because the first time there was so much opposition, and then they sort of ramped up the fear factor, and it was just like, you know, either we pass this thing or the whole world collapses, and they managed to get it through. But there was originally quite a lot of public opposition to TARP, particularly to the lack of oversight. So they had to make some changes to make it a little bit more palatable to people. But, you know, ultimately, I think what people were so offended by as this whole thing unfolded was the lack of strings attached to the huge amount of money that the banks got. It was not the idea of some kind of strong action. I think there were two key pieces of it. One was, why are they getting bailed out and why are homeowners not getting bailed out? Why is the bailout not for the broader society? One. But the other was, okay, if we're going to help them this much, and it wasn't just $700 billion, it was trillions of dollars when you count the Federal Reserve's loan guarantees, it was, what are we going to ask of them in exchange for this extraordinary largesse? And at the time, I made the analogy of the International Monetary Fund, you know, when they go and bail out Greece, for instance, or you know, Italy, or you know, anywhere that they're bailing out, they always have quite an extensive list of demands. That's to be called structural adjustment.
Yes, I was going to say restructuring.
So why didn't we structurally adjust the banks in exchange for that? And we didn't. And everybody has witnessed the incredible accumulation of wealth at the very top, the concentration of wealth that has continued because of that failure to put any kind of stops on Wall Street greed. And so people are in the streets.
The Shock Doctrine, the Shock Resistance. Naomi Klein, our guest, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Now, you wrote us before coming in that the image that caused you to pack your bags and finally head toward Wall Street from Canada, where you're from, was of a young woman, arms aloft, holding a sign that said, "I care about you." Didn't say end the foreclosure crisis. It didn't say arrest the bank presidents or tax the rich. It said, "I care about you." Why was that your moment?
Oh, I guess that makes me sound quite soft, but I really found it tremendously moving, and I really think she's right that when we think about how we change the society, you know, Nick Kristof wrote this article in the Times giving the Wall Street protesters advice about what their demands should be,
and it was four items for legislation: change the capital gains tax, things like that.
It was all good stuff, but very wonky. And you know, the more time I spend with these young protesters, the more inspired I become that their project is really about trying to change the culture of that we live in, so that it is less focused on greed. Yes, they want to change the banking system too, but I think they want more than that.
And it's exactly the thing that they're getting criticized for,
exactly,
for being so amorphous or vague.
Well, I'm just happy that they are not foreclosing on the big dreams right now, because I think it would be really dispiriting if they came up with a bunch of wonky demands that you can read in a very good New York Times column. Wes Jackson, I don't know if you know him. He's a farmer theorist. He works with Wendell Berry, runs something called the Land Institute in Kansas. And he says that we have to have the courage to ask questions that go beyond the available answers. We don't actually know how to achieve the changes that we want right now. Let's be honest. You know, if you're a young person in Egypt, And you want change, it's a little bit more straightforward to overthrow a dictator than it is to think about how you challenge this vast, amorphous global system that we are all in. So that's why I love that sign saying, "I care about you," in the heart of Wall Street, where we're so trained to harden our hearts to each other. I contrast that with the let them die moment. I'm sorry, it's a little bit easy in the Republican debates, but this is what we're taught to do. To live in a society that puts greed above all else, you have to learn not to care about other people. And it's quite an art. And if you work on Wall Street, you're really, really good at it. You're really, really good at disconnecting between what you do all day and the way that affects real people and real lives. And so just seeing this young woman holding the sign that said, "I care about you," I thought, they're going deep, and deep is what we need.
You were downtown yesterday, right?
Yeah.
And it was funny, kind of, to see the AFL-CIO and other establishment progressives joining in behind the ragtag band of young people no one ever heard of, rather than the other way around. What did that look like to you, and what do you think it means?
The unions are so embattled right now, particularly public sector unions. And there's so much vilification in this culture. That's part of how we harden our hearts to each other. Is that we find ways to dismiss each other all the time. They're lazy unions, big unions, whatever the slur is. There's something about a new generation of young people stepping up that is so refreshing, in part because they don't carry the baggage. It is a lot harder to blame these young people for the problems that we have, because they're obviously a 19-year-old, who's looking at massive student debt and graduating into an economy where she's not going to get a job, did absolutely nothing to create this crisis. And they can say that very clearly. And it's a really powerful moral rallying cry when you have a youth-led movement. And this is not just happening here. Youth are leading movements that become mass movements, intergenerational movements in Spain, in Egypt, in Israel right now. It's in Chile, it's incredible. These young student activists have come forward. They're demanding free education, a reversal of Pinochet's privatization. They're coming forward, and it's woken up the country. It's amazing.
But how much can you say or suggest that all these things are linked? Israel has its particular economics that is bringing people out into the streets there. Greece is literally going broke, and the people are getting hit with much harsher austerity measures directly imposed than here. Are these really – and, the Arab Spring is certainly its whole other thing with respect to the dictators, even though there were economic triggers for Tunisia – and elsewhere. How much can you say they are linked?
They are not the same. It's not one movement, but I think that there is a spirit that's contagious. Somebody had a sign that said Arab Spring, European Summer, American Fall yesterday, a big banner. And everybody understands that it's different. It's, as I said, it's the process of how you imagine change. If you're in Egypt and you're overthrowing a dictator, is completely different than thinking about it as a young U.S. citizen. But those young Egyptians who overthrew Mubarak are now realizing that many of the issues that are closest to their hearts around economic equality, a reaction against the corrupt privatizations of Mubarak's government, they're realizing that they don't know how to get at those issues. And this is something else I read about in the Shock Doctrine, about you have these huge liberation struggles, like in South Africa, overthrowing legal apartheid. But because they didn't have a plan for how to deal with economics, they ended up with a more unequal society.
I've heard from at least one person who's offended by comparisons like that are coming up now, saying, the people in Greece, certainly the people in Egypt, wish they had the conditions that are in the United States that people are protesting.
In fact, there's so much excitement around the world about what's happening in the United States. I mean, this is playing huge everywhere else. And we watch U.S. media, and the question is, why are they protesting? And everywhere else in the world, the question is, like, what took them so long? Because the whole world watched the unbelievable transfer of wealth that took place in this country from public hands to private hands during the so-called bailout. And the question was, how long are Americans going to put up with this? And I think there was so much hope that was invested in the Obama presidency. There was so much love for Obama among progressives. That for a long time, people were just waiting and seeing. If it had been a Republican in power, people would have been in the streets in this country years ago. So it's taken a while, but I don't think people outside this country are going, you have it so great, what are you protesting about?
Naomi Klein, author of No Logo and the Shock Doctrine, down from Canada to speak to the Occupy Wall Street protest today. Frank in Chester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The fact of the matter is, using TARP as an indication of an abuse of the banks is wrong, because TARP got paid back with a very good response and also with a profit to the government. If you want to look at abuses, you look at the money that was spent in bailing out Chrysler and General Motors, which a good portion will never get paid back to the government. And the reality is, the people on Wall Street right now protesting have no focus, and without a focus, they're not going to accomplish anything. Right? They're having a hell of a lot of fun, and they're getting a lot of media attention. And it's great for the pundits to talk about it. But the reality is that it's not going to accomplish anything for our economy. We have an economy that people want services, but they don't want to pay for them. So they want the rich to pay for them, which is fine. I understand that. I haven't fallen in that category. But the reality is we can't afford, all right, a society that people don't pay for the goods that they want.
Naomi Klein? Frank, let's stay there. Let's get a response.
Yeah, I don't think that people are protesting because of TARP. I think that they're protesting because, as I said earlier, that the decision was made to bail out the banks, but not to bail out homeowners, but not to bail out workers. And you see a lot of these signs, you know, where's my bailout? I've got $70,000 in student loans and so on. And you think about these young people, the loans that they accumulated to get their education was based on a kind of a promise that there would be jobs for them, that there would be opportunities for them, and those jobs aren't there, and the debt is terrifying to them. So I don't think it is just about, you know, whether or not U.S. taxpayers got paid back by TARP. It's about those priorities, and as I said, it's also about the fact that that the power of Wall Street is so tremendous that they were able to fight back serious regulations. This is the Obama generation. These are the young people who knocked on doors and slept on floors for Obama, and they haven't gotten the change that they wanted. And now they've decided to go where they see the real power is. They don't believe it's in Washington. They think it's on Wall Street, and that Washington is owned by Wall Street, and that's why they're there.
Frank, thank you for your call. Call us again. Robert in Manhattanville, you're on WNYC with Naomi Klein. Hi.
I disagree with, as a progressive, with Naomi. You look at the Tea Party, which is sort of the revolution on the right, and they have taken over the government, and they did so electorally because they galvanized their people. They had, of course, those who sought to take advantage of the populism of the movement, whether it be Karl Rove or the Koch brothers, and they translated that in our society into electoral power. And now they're dominating, and it's quite frankly, it's sort of a legal coup d'etat. And it strikes me that your show yesterday with the two mics, the two union leaders, I think amplifies what needs to be done. It's not a function. One of your callers said it's about paying for services. No, that's not what it's about. If Naomi's right that it's about accountability, I think what the New York State's Attorney General is doing with his lawsuits is one response, but the progressive movement could have very simple solutions. We're not talking about just taxing the rich. It should be a progressive income tax. It should be accountability by financial services. It should be things like the mortgage-backed securities that were fraud. Really what we want is the type of progressive regulation that just ensures honesty and a distribution of wealth that is fair, not biased to the top, but fair.
So if these protesters are saying, I care about you first, and kind of setting a cultural tone, maybe they're setting us up to get to things like that in a way that the people who are already a little bit cynical and wonky haven't been able to.
Well, because the point is
revolution, and we're talking about it really going back to what it was. I don't think that type of soft, I feel for you, I love you, will work.
All right, I'm going to leave it
there
for time.
That's not all. I just gave that as one example. anybody who's been down there, there's a lot of rage. There's also all kinds of concrete ideas about what to do. They just haven't decided exactly what their political program is. And I think it's absurd to think that they would have. This is a group that has come together 3 weeks ago. They've created a space where they can have that discussion. You make the comparison with the Tea Party. They have proposals. It's not that we don't have proposals among progressives. There's no shortage of ideas about how to regulate the banks, how to reform the tax system, how to get money from the military budget and move it to healthcare and education. We have lots of ideas. What we don't have is power. What we don't have is political power. And I reject the comparison with the Tea Party. The Tea Party has huge amounts of corporate money behind that. We will never have that among progressives. And we have to make up for what we don't have with corporate money, with bodies, with mass movements. It's the only way it's ever happened. And that's what is exciting about Occupy Wall Street. How could you be cynical about something that is causing such inspiration across the country? I'm amazed by progressives who think that their job right now is to lecture these young people rather than support them.
Before you go, and by the way, what time are you speaking there today? Is it scheduled?
6 o'clock.
Do you have anything to say about the passing of Steve Jobs? Were you a fan? Is there any Naomi Klein lens for analyzing his work?
Well, yeah, I wrote about Apple a fair bit, actually, in my first book, In No Logo. I wrote about their use of revolutionary imagery. The Think Different campaign was one of the examples, really.
For the Mac.
Yeah, and the creation of lifestyle branding and the co-opting of revolutionary movements of the past. You know, the image of Gandhi, Think Different. The image of Martin Luther King, Think Different. And it was funny because the other thing I wrote about in the book was the rise of ad busting and culture jamming. There emerged a movement of young people that came to world attention in Seattle. You started to see these ad busts or culture jams of the Mac ads, where you'd see young people rising up and it would say, think really different. But that said, you know, I learned how to use computers on a Mac, and as an untechie young woman, I really appreciated the fact that this was a friendly computer to me. But I think it's these protests and around the world are empowered and enabled by technology that Steve Jobs popularized and made available. At the same time, they also are speaking to a desire among this generation that grew up so plugged in and glued to their screens to connect with each other in the real world. And that's the contradiction of Steve Jobs. This is a Buddhist man who gave us the tools to be less in the moment than anything else. I say that as, you know, an addict.
You know, an early New York Times article on Occupy Wall Street ended with a kind of dismissive reference to all these young protesters sporting Apple products and having no idea where they came from. Is there something in there we should be talking about today?
I do think we should be talking about the built-in obsolescence of these technologies. And I think we need to identify what it is that we do love about them and we do need about them. But it doesn't have to be a package deal. We should not have to buy, you know, a new phone every year, a new computer every 2 years. It's outrageous.
Invented in America but made in China.
Yeah, and with natural resources that are finite and are extracted from countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, amongst enormous conflict. We need to talk about the downside as well, and we need to, you know, we can have more power in these equations, so we can take what's good and we can say we want to be able to fix them.
And maybe good to remember that most of the world cannot afford an Apple anything.
That's true. That's very true.
Naomi Klein, author of No Logo and The Shock Doctrine, in town to speak to Occupy Wall Street today. Thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Brian
Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will introduce you to the work of the Nobel Prize for Literature winner, somebody, unless you're really into poetry, you have never heard of, even though he is huge around the world in poetry circles. So stay with us as we read a little bit from the Swedish winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature just announced this morning. Stay tuned.